Is meditation better than yoga?
Meditation is yoga. Okay. Yoga means union. And union with what? Union with the divine, the deepest level of life, the highest level of life. Union.
We need female Joe Rogans who believe the opposite shit, and we don't have them.
Oh no. Look who's with them. Queen bitch of the universe.
Welcome back, party people. Welcome back to another episode of This Body Podcast, Yoga Ethics for Modern Living. Did you miss me? I missed you. It's stormy in Southern Cali right now, which is very romantic, very moody. I'm having a cozy time. I have no notes. After this episode, there's only one more in this series on the Yummers and the Yummers. Amazing. We've come so far. After this series is done and dusted, I'm going to take a little break from the free feed, maybe a month or so, to plan and prepare and ruminate for the next season of This Body, which is tentatively entitled Between Two Worlds, and I'll be exploring the spiritual lessons of David Lynch and Twin Peaks. So this is going to be really fun, you guys. Make sure you're subscribed in your podcast app. And if you want to keep abreast of the situation, then join up to Patreon for bonus episodes. They won't be interrupted. A steady drip of yours truly is set to continue. Patreon.com/thisbodypodcast. Sign up. You can also try it out for a week for free. You'll see that option on the $6 level when you go to sign up. Or you could just throw caution to the wind and sign up at the apocalypse stakeholder level. That's $50 a month because money grows on trees and the economy is booming. Am I right? How's life? Hope you're well. Hope your life hasn't been impacted by these tariffs. Got the fright of my life last night when I saw that a certain stubby-fingered grotesquitarian is trying to, or is, imposing a 100% tariff on movies made outside of the United States.
Please, I'm a star!
This isn't good, guys. It's not good at all. We need a little bit of, a little discernment, a little nuance over there in the Oval Office, a little yoga, if you will. That's the bloody least of it. It seems a conclusion has been reached after 1 week of, quote, very strong research that countries not America are stealing movies through their tax incentives, and thus a 100% tariff may be, will be, levied on films not made here. And this is just wild, wild. What will this look like in practice, I wonder? Only American stories for American people set in America? Where are we filming? Indiana? Texas? I'm confused. What about, like, the next White Lotus? No more filming on locations? No more Mission Impossible franchise, which is filmed all over the world for the locations, not the tax credits. What's going to happen to the films that are already in the can or being filmed right now and slated to come out in summer, like Ballerina, the John Wick sequel, which was filmed in the Czech Republic, Avatar, Fire and Ash was filmed in New Zealand, a place that's become a production hub over the past 20 to 30 years. Thanks to the vision of Lord of the Rings filmmaker Peter Jackson, a national hero. I mean, I might be naive, but I really don't think that any green screen can compete with the South Island landscapes in New Zealand. The new Avengers and Spider-Man installments are being filmed in London, as is the new Star Wars movie. And then there's Saudi Arabia, which is a whole other story, which, I mean, it's worth a deep dive if you're bored, got nothing to do. It's a really great article, or a few articles, about Saudi in Vanity Fair as it pertains to the film industry. Cinema was banned in Saudi Arabia for 35 years. Oh, can you believe? But now there's this new kind of, not so new, lunatic Nepo baby, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He seems like a real loser, 39 years old, no brain to speak of, no rationale to anything he does, of course. These dictators' children are just sort of blobs. But he's obviously in control of millions of people and trillions of dollars. Saudi's main thing is oil. But MBS, as they call him, really wants to be a cool international man of enterprise. And as such, he's set about creating a film industry in Saudi Arabia, I guess to like make it seem like a more fun place to go after 35 years of no movies. But yeah, this film industry that he's created provides a 40% tax rebate for foreign filmmakers, which is just, I mean, you can't compete with that. That's fucking huge. He launched this new industry by bringing in two aging fail sons of American cinema, Will Smith and Johnny Depp. Lame. So sorry to the women of Saudi Arabia for having to put up with that, amongst other things.
Guys love asking where the bitches are at, but they never look inside themselves. Like, they're right in there. Just look.
This idea that movies should only be made in America. I don't know, man. Seems like the rest of the world is the enemy. It's just so awful, which I guess is the point. Hollywood's been having this intense struggle over the past few years. It's been heartbreaking living in Los Angeles and like seeing your neighbors and stuff really struggling. You know, there was COVID and then the writer's strike, and writing jobs are down by 42%. The showrunners are directing TikToks. Hopefully this tariff announcement will just go away, like most of these chaotic threats seem to do. They're a bit of a distraction. Whatever happens, it's not very nice. It doesn't feel very nice. Kind of like how it didn't feel very nice when thousands of government workers were told that they were shitty, superfluous to requirements, and summarily fired. In many cases, this came after a lifetime of loyal service to America. It's very Elon with a chainsaw right now. I don't actually remember when America was great, if it ever was, but I remember thinking it was pretty fun once upon a time. All the fun's been sucked out of the place lately. Jeez.
Over. It's over. I mean, you got here just in time for the death rattle. Last gasp. Last grope.
It's never been more important to ground oneself in reality and align with one's own internal compass. Am I right? I am.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
A couple of weeks back, I remembered I had a bottle of Hello Kitty wine that my real estate agent gave me a couple of years ago. I don't drink. Not that I had a drinking problem or have a drinking problem, but I just don't think about it. I used to buy beer and wine when I went to the supermarket, but then I married a musician.
You're an ass. You're a total ass. I want a divorce. You.
And whenever I'd go to the fridge to grab a beer, they'd be all gone. It was so fucking annoying. I just stopped wasting my money on booze so that he couldn't steal it. I just switched 100% over to weed, California sober. But when I remembered the other day that I had this bottle of wine, I thought I'd better open it. It's been 3 years. I should at least throw it in my pasta sauce. How nice could Hello Kitty wine be anyway? I was expecting gross. Well, guess what? Hello Kitty Pinot Noir is fucking delicious, you guys. I had a great couple of days finishing off that bottle, getting a little buzz on by myself at home. I was like, wow, yeah, I get why people drink. This is lovely. Well, then I was at Whole Foods in Palm Springs the next day doing a little grocery shopping, and I noted the booze aisle, which is something that I usually don't even clock at all. And I meandered around and I took in like the endless selection of wine, which is just so overwhelming. How does anyone know what the fuck anything tastes like? You know, that was another reason that I stopped buying alcohol, because I just didn't know shit about wine, no matter what. Just always blanked on what I liked and would end up with some gross bottle that I felt like was a waste of money. But anyway, I was looking at the wines and I was thinking of buying some or one or whatever. And then I just realized, no, this is how it happens. This is how middle-aged women become alcoholics. Or if not full-blown alcoholics, then just like messy, unhealthy, unclear. In that wine aisle, I envisage my whole life, how it could turn out, aging in the desert heat, bottle of Jack Daniels in my hand, screaming at the passers-by, and probably praying on Sundays. So I took myself in hand and walked to the vegetable aisle, where I grabbed Persian cucumbers and organic mushrooms, which are $1 more than non-organic and probably the exact same product. I wonder if Persian cucumbers are going to be tariffed for not being American. Anyway, you might be thinking, well, if she smokes weed, she might die of lung cancer. And to that I say, maybe. But given the choice between lung failure and liver failure, I prefer lung, according to the TikTok doctors that I have seen detail these wonderful demises. Liver failure is long, it's harrowing, it's just fucked up, and I wouldn't want to inflict that on any nurse or doctor. They've already been through enough. I mean, just standing in the ER for like 5 minutes is probably more than enough for anybody. I am just trying to be a thoughtful patient, not inflict any more trauma than necessary on others. That's ahimsa.
That's amore.
Remember ahimsa, the OG of the Yoga Sutras? Do no harm, non-violence, babes. This little tale of self-restraint dovetails into today's topic. We're talking about Svadhyaya. What's that, you say? Well, you may be forgiven for thinking it's on the shelf at Erewhon next to the ashwagandha, or to me it sounds like a complementary therapy to ayahuasca, psychedelic. Svadhyaya, or self-study, it's one of the cornerstones of the yoga practice, and today we're going to talk about how self-awareness can improve your life in 2025. It's Yoga Ethics for Modern Living. When I was a teen, I fought psychotically with my mother, and sometimes these fights would get physical. My mother had a bipolar diagnosis, and something I can attest to is that when people are having a manic episode, they sometimes possess superhuman strength. So just remember that. Put that in your back pocket. You never know when you might come face to face with somebody having a violent bipolar episode, and that information should inform how you proceed. But anyway, one time I was fighting with my mother and she slapped me across the face hard, and I just had about enough of this shit, so I lifted up my hand to hit her back, and she like grabbed it midair like the Terminator, wrestled my arm behind my back. This woman had no fighting training or anything, and I think I was bigger than her by this stage, younger, stronger, Anyway, wrestled my arm behind my back, forced me in front of the mirror in the hallway, where in this very cinematic, psychotic fashion, she like screams at me, just look at yourself, look, while like forcing me to look in the mirror. And that's what we're going to do today. We're just going to fucking take a look at ourselves, our motivations, our addictions, the monkeys on our backs that run the show. So I've never read any books by that guy Eckhart Tolle.
What the fuck is going on in here on this day?
But I know how to look up quotes by smart people on Goodreads. I was listening to Planet Heather the other day. She has read these books by Eckhart Tolle. He wrote this big deal book called The Power of Now. And in there he talks about being suicidally depressed and stuff. And one night he was so down that he just felt like he could not live with himself a moment longer. Here's the quote. I cannot live with myself anymore. This was the thought that kept repeating itself in my mind. Then suddenly I became aware of what a peculiar thought it was. Am I one or two? If I cannot live with myself, there must be two of me, the I and the self that I cannot live with. Maybe, I thought, only one of them is real. Yes, so you are not your thoughts. You are the thinker. My own self-study didn't really kick off until my 20s. No, my 30s, I don't reckon. Before that, I did yoga as much as I could, like the physical yoga, but I was in this very heavy scene of people, and my identity was kind of comprised of my position, my social and my work life, which were one and the same. If people liked me, that was good. And when people didn't, it was like a challenge. But it kind of, my self-image, I think, just sort of bounced off exterior things. I was really busy building something. There was no time to even contemplate that there might be two me's, the thinker and the observer. And it's here that I want to bring in the idea that self-reflection is a privilege, because sometimes people will say, well, you know, it's all very well to want to do self-development, but that's a luxury. I don't think it's accurate to say that only people with money have the time and impetus to meditate and watch their thoughts, because that is not true at all. In fact, in my experience, the more financially bountiful people are, the more gusto they can employ when they run from themselves. But there is something to be said for having that space. When you have money, you get to like buy back your time, which is obviously our most precious commodity. Commodity? It's not a commodity. No, it is a commodity, because if you can buy it back, oh God, okay, that's just a depressing capitalistic thought game. We won't go there. But yeah, often through having time and space to yourself, the idea that there's more to the self can bubble to the surface. But the same can be said for like the frustration of living hand to mouth. Sometimes those circumstances are what leads a person to seek more understanding about themselves and where they're really coming from and why. So according to the Yoga Sutras, the practice of Svadhyaya, self-study in yoga, is said to be found in nature, in scripture, and in introspection. So it's about access to those things. I guess society doesn't actually support nature or introspection or sacred texts outside of using them to manipulate the masses. So in this sense, we're all a bit disenfranchised. Wealthy people have more access to nature, but that doesn't mean that they sit in it, wrestle with the ego and the freaky nature of natural spaces. Being alone in stark nature can be really terrifying, you know? You know what I mean? The airiness of it, the lack of personal significance. It's a reckoning that many people put off indefinitely. So I'm here today to tell you to get curious about yourself, What's the worst that can happen? You won't die. You will. That's coming for you. There's no escaping that. But self-reflection ain't gonna kill you. Wouldn't you rather deal with yourself now while you can direct your sails and live consciously with intention rather than like be a mess on your deathbed stressing out your kids because you're terrified of the inevitable that you steadfastly refuse to look at for your entire life? That's very burdensome. The best gift that you can give your loved ones is a life well lived. So just start there. How do we connect to this kind of self-study? You'll never guess. Meditation. One day a few years ago when I was working as a music coordinator, I was with my boss who was at the time a music supervisor, and we're having like a really fucking busy day because it's like such a busy job. We were flying all around LA going from place to place, high stress, really hot. And we were in Atwater Village with a break of like an hour or something between meetings. So I suggested that we just sit in the car with the windows down and I'd set a timer for 5 minutes and we'd just be quiet. And so we did that, 5 minutes in the hot car. Years later, my boss still talked about that 5 minutes, how nice it was, how valuable. 5 quiet minutes, can you do that? Or are you too busy? Oh my gosh, you guys, if you like this show, you should join me over on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thisbodypodcast and join up for Extra Body. You'll get early access to episodes, 2 bonus episodes a month, random drops here and there, and access to old seasons. Another thing I like to do when I find myself racing through the experience of life, which honestly, I've been doing that a lot lately. I've been pretty unconscious. I don't know if that's really true, but like I've caught myself being unconscious. I've caught myself eating really fast and not like savoring the things that I've been looking forward to. So this exercise that's really fun is like you take a piece of food that you really like. For me, it's like a chocolate or a piece of fruit. And instead of masticating furiously, just hold it in your mouth and notice how your taste buds go crazy. Your whole physical experience like pops off at the delight of just a little taste. Slowing things down, savoring. Did you know they discovered a new color last week? It's called Olo. It's kind of like teal or turquoise, but not. And only 5 people have seen it. And for us to see it, we'd need to get our eyeballs lasered. With self-study, svadhyaya, you might find a whole color palette you didn't know about. Through watching your thoughts, you may find you can intercept negative behavior before it fucks up your life. Inception that shit. Like self-sabotage, negative self-talk, that's a big one. Just noticing those mean thoughts, self-negating stuff that you can actually divorce yourself from once you recognize.
You're an ass. You're a total ass. I want a divorce. You.
If you always identify with those thoughts, you are detached from the discernment to change your reactions. In yoga, there's this tiny sacred kernel of soul, kind of, called Purusha, and it's inside all of us. Just think of it as the soul, for simplicity's sake. The rest of life is material, and that's called Prakriti. Everything. In your home, everything in the material world is Prakriti. The body is Prakriti, the brain. So once you realize that your body is the home and the home is material and the only eternal thing is your little kernel of a soul, Purusha, it makes sense that the mind can take us on very convincing journeys because we think that we are the mind. We are not the mind. According to the ancient yogis, we suffer because we think that we are the boxes that we're wrapped in when we're really the divine hiding inside. Isn't that nice? So the wisdom goes that through the process of knowing ourselves and being engaged in that process, we find the ability to shift focus from the ego self, the material self, the boxes we live inside, move from that to the witness mind, and then finally to our true nature, which is divinity itself. Very pleasant sounding, isn't it? Like the sound of desert rain on my roof right now. People don't generally just decide to do serious self-inquiry out of the blue when nothing's wrong. Usually what happens is you get to some point in life where shit isn't working, you're not jiving with this version of yourself, something uncomfortable is going on, and you want to escape the discomfort. Suffering is such a good motivator, and that's very human. I think the thing to do with that energy is to maintain it, like shore it up, like keep interested in it beyond like a capricious, faddish sort of interest. Svadhyaya is a skill to cultivate and strengthen all the way through. Like if you think of tennis, a skillful tennis player isn't going to pick up a racket for like 5 days a year and the rest of the time just loaf on the couch playing the new GTA. Their game would be very sloppy if they did that. So, you know, you have to tap in. You have to like show up, as they say. Show up to your life. So when we're self-studying, we find out that a lot of the ways we understand the world comes from the frame of childhood, when worldviews were served to us like just little flat pictures inside a frame with borders, like binaries. But we live inside a kaleidoscope of three spatial dimensions, length, width, and height, and one temporal one, time. And that's just what we experience. Some string theorists predict there are at least 10 dimensions in the universe, most of which we can't comprehend, of course, just like the color Olo. Damn, that is so insane. So if there's like possibly 10 dimensions and we just have, I get the three, the spatial dimensions, length, width, height. I can understand how there could be like lots more things like that. But the temporal one, time, what are the other dimensions? Oh my God. What a trip. What a thought experiment. Ooh, makes me feel scared. Anyway, there it is. So yeah, we don't know if the case for dimensions is factual, whether they're there or not, but you know what I mean, right? First we imagine something, then we do it. First we theorize, then we prove. That's what the Prakriti is good for. And that's a trip, don't you think? How amazing that our limitless soul has been given this fleshy, weird, electrical body to like sense the life experience out with. Makes me think of a snail inside its shell, but with like those little feelers, its eyes on sticks, feeling things out. What a weird place we find ourselves in, my fellow humans. There's pleasure, there's pain, there's suffering. Then there's holding a piece of mango in your mouth without chewing. Sensational. Babes, if you enjoy this podcast, be sure to rate, share, and subscribe. You can listen on Apple, Spotify, and Amazon Music. And you can find me at Sophia Forever. The pod's on IG too. Thanks, Tiger. The ego is what keeps us alive. Our brain's thinking keeps us alive. We don't need to be at war with the self in any way, shape, or form. I watched this documentary the other day on this woman called Cher Height. She wrote these books in the 70s. I think it might have just been, no, it was more than one book. She was a feminist researcher And she wrote this book, The Height Report, which was a collection of answers to surveys that she'd sent out to thousands of people, asking them like frank questions about their sexuality. Basically the gist, or what the media kind of pinned it all down to make it sensational and something that they could run with for a really long time, was the fact of the clitoral orgasm. She illuminated through her research, which was really other people illuminating things for us about their sexual experiences, that while women generally found intercourse really pleasurable, they didn't often reach orgasm through intercourse alone, and direct clitoral stimulation was required for a woman to achieve orgasm. That was just a part of the research, but like I said, this is what the American media glommed onto. And this was the 70s, so it was all fucked up. She went on a lot of talk shows and stuff with men, and at one point they showed a talk show that had only men, like all men in the audience. She was the only woman in the room. It was just, really annoying, because these guys were super macho and were just so pissed off with her for simply stating the biological fact of the female orgasm. It was so sad to see. It was awful. I took it really personally. All she was saying was that in slowing down the experience and being fully present and then very intentional, both people are going to have a really fucking amazing time together. Like, the threat of the penis not being the thing to bring a woman to an easy orgasm, so much so that pleasure and love and joy aren't interesting to these men. That's ego at its worst. Those men need to fucking meditate and just look at themselves. The ego has a function to keep us alive. When the ego thinks it's the boss, that's when shit gets fucked up. A person's belief system becomes their whole reality. The idea of individuation becomes primary and the world contracts. On the topic of scripture, so for modern yogis, reading scripture could actually be watching an inspiring documentary about someone whose life is exceptional, along with the Cher Height doc. I also watched one called The World According to Ali Willis, someone you've probably never heard of. I hadn't. But someone who had a huge impact on the world. She wrote this song, Remember, for Earth, Wind, and Fire. She wrote the musical, The Color Purple, with two other writers. She wrote the Friends theme song for the Rembrandts. She wrote What Have I Done to Deserve This by the Pet Shop Boys. That song, You're the Best, from Beverly Hills Cop, on and on. And then she became an incredible visual artist and art director. She won a Tony. Her creativity was just ridiculous, honestly. And as I was watching it, I was like, you've just got to be kidding. This can't be real. And that was scripture to me. Yoga scripture for modern living on Hulu. Svadhyaya can really suck. When we interrogate our pain and make connections, it can just be really awful. Emotional release, contrary to the Hollywood narrative, isn't fun. You don't feel cleansed per se afterwards. Sometimes it's really heavy and it just feels really gross. It can also feel discouraging, because you might expect something from emotional release that didn't come. So you may feel discouraged. And it's that moment that sends most people out of the solitude of self-study and back into the material world. Take me anywhere, don't care, don't care, don't. When you're feeling all horrendous with self-study, it's helpful to remember all those dimensions and colors that we can't see. We've got an idea that progress should be like a graph trending upwards or downwards, but graphs are flat, and what we're doing in life is we're living in like a spherical, corkscrewing, spiral path kind of dimension. So letting go of expectation, anticipations, hopes, fears, plans, all of that linear thinking, that one thing leads to another, if that were true, we'd all have great lives because, you know, most of us have been trying pretty hard to have a great life. The Buddhists are into beginner's mind. You don't know what you don't know, and that is humbling, and being humble is a good place to start. Be humble. Sit down. There's this concept in yoga of the Atman, the God self, and the Sutra Atman, which I think of as God on a string. In Ketona Yoga, there's a meditation on this where you like, we can actually do it together, even if you're not sitting down. But if you are driving, obviously, don't do this. So sit up tall or stand still and lengthen your spine and close your eyes. Soften your jaw, soften your tongue, let your shoulder blades drop down your back. From here, you're going to imagine a golden thread coming down from the heavens, down through the crown of your head, down the back of your palate, all the way down your spine, grounding out through your tailbone, into the center of the earth, all the way down, lengthening tall and feeling yourself grounded. So this is like your central axis, a plumb line, this through line. And you're just going to organize yourself around the center line. So feel like your right lung, your left hip bone, left shoulder, right hip. So you organize yourself around this through line, this principle of God on a string, grounding you to the core of the earth, into the highest of the heavens. And everything has its own space, its own room around that line. You can think of it as the main pipe for hot water. If you organize yourself around that as a principle, you can not like autopilot through life, you know, but it's ethics. It makes things clear. I had a fence built a couple of years back, and first of all, they laid the pillars, I guess you could call them, you know, the really strong pieces of wood that fortify. Oh, the posts. They laid the posts to perfection, cemented them in, and then hammered the rest of the fence in. Now, I wanted my fence to be horizontal, not vertical, because I like the look of it better. That's my material preference, and that makes those posts all the more important. Without well-laid posts, the fence would blow across the desert in the first winds. In case it's not clear, the posts are a metaphor for your ethics. So ram those posts in hard, because the answers, my friends, are not blowing in the wind. See you next time. We'll be right back.